Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
That's how real it is. I think somebody's trying to kill me. I'll be waking up paranoid. I'll be really scared. I'll just be paro. That's just the way I am.
The Great Boss has spoken! Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain!
Who are you? Who are you?
A very bad man!
I'm a very good man. Good man. They think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. Just a very bad wizard.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tamler Summers from the University of Houston. Dave, Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and now Pluribus, has said about AI that it's the most expensive and energy-intensive plagiarism machine. I think there's a very high possibility that this is all a bunch of horseshit. Now, you know that I agree with him on this, so go ahead, defend your boy. By your boy, I mean AI.
I was going to say, who am I defending here? Like, we're on the same page about art and AI.
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like that's what you're focused on primarily in your attacks on AI. Because what you never say is, for instance, that our Patreon members have a new feature that automatically divides up their Ask Us Anything questions into chapter markers because of AI. Like, that's the kind of shit that you're just like, hey, yeah, like that's just whatever, normal computing.
If that's AI, that's, I guess, great. Although I'm not, is it AI that's doing that even?
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I'm sure there's stuff like that. But, you know, obviously it's kind of ruining like universities and like education. So it's not just art. It's like its effect on students right now, I think, is absolutely poisonous and like soul destroying. So I think my hatred of it goes well beyond the ridiculous things that people claim about it in art. Like that is the most ludicrous part of it.
It is. The art part of it is soul crushing for sure. The other stuff to me is such a mixed blessing. Like we're having like the ability to better diagnose like x-rays because of these models, right? Like not relying on individual doctors, like getting this like amazing stuff. It's just, it comes with this cost. And you know what that cost is? We have to do our job better. Like we as professors have to like find a way to inspire
our students.
Oh yeah,
we have to incorporate AI into our
class. Not incorporate, inspire our students to like not be tempted by like the thought.
I don't know, like I was optimistic on that front a lot more in September than I am now. As far as the x-rays and the cancer and like all this stuff that people claim, I'd really like to see more that, because all I've heard is people just say it. And it sounds like a way of like hospitals saving money on having actual people look at something.
I mean, there's a lot of that, right? But like I just don't expect that if somebody publishes a paper on the ability to detect cancerous cells using machine learning that you're going to sit there and read it and be like, ah, I'm convinced.
No, I would. I have an open mind. I'm very objective.
Let's ask ChatGPT to summarize the research.
Yeah. I think like the most impressive thing I've ever seen it do is if like you want to search something and then you want to ask follow-up questions about the search. And like that's the like one time where I'm like, okay, this could be kind of helpful. But every other thing that people tell me it's good for, like every time I try it, I find it like kind of just useless. And also like I have a negative fringe experience, as William James would call it. Although I don't think he would use that exact phrase.
But like, I just think that you're not the target audience for like what these machine learning models do. I think that it's like actually unlocking a lot of really interesting things. Like for instance, in scholarship, the ability to look at a tablet of whatever cuneiform that has previously been like, you know, impossible to glean the meaning from, like these machine learning models can like actually bring insight into stuff. Like there's, of course, all the stuff that you're saying is true about like its influence on university students, but I think it's sort of just ignoring a huge swath of powerful things that are coming with these models.
Mm. Yeah. When did they get to you? Like, what happened?
I'm not going to say anything bad about them here.
What, like, is it, are they threatening you? Are they
It's the Pornhub ads that say AI women at your disposal.
Are you trying to get some of that Walter Sinnott Armstrong money? What are you up to?
That's sweet, sweet AI money. But on that note, by the way, of what you were saying, like, I, for instance, today when we were prepping for our main segment, I was finding it hard to understand how James was using a specific set of terms. Like, his use of the words neuroses and psychoses is just weird to me. I don't know if you caught that. And so I asked GPT, like, can you explain, like, how he's using these? And it gave me, like, a real, I mean, it might be a lie. It might be complete.
Yeah, it might be a hallucination, but great.
But it sounded legit.
Do we need to issue, like, a disclaimer for this episode? Yeah. Some of this,
I'm just going to be reading a script.
May all be completely made up.
Absolutely. I'd love to help you with that.
Oh, that's such a great question. You are so smart. Like, I'm just in awe of how smart you are.
That's what it is, Tamler. You don't like the sycophantic nature of it because your twisted personality is such that you need, like, your balls stepped on by a machine.
I need, yeah. I want it to, like, time me up, like spread eagle, the face down on the bed.
It hasn't negged you effectively yet. Meanwhile, I love that, you know. I love people telling me how smart my questions are.
All right, so you've prepped for today entirely using ChatGPT.
It's actually, the whole thing's going to be a script. As you say things, it'll be pumping out answers.
Oh, right. You're keeping a window open right now.
I'm going to use the black guy voice, like, to respond. Just like, that actually is creepy to me. You can choose the voices for GPT.
You talk to it?
You can.
Yeah.
I don't. I have, yeah.
I didn't even know that. I mean, it makes sense. Like, they know, yeah, they have the technology to do that. But
like, I swear there's a voice that's a black guy. And I was trying to point this out to Nikki, and she's like, it doesn't sound like a black guy to me. And I was like, yeah, you know, you're just not part of the people, you know? Because it's just like, absolutely, I'd love to get that for you.
Like, like a Denzel Washington kind of.
I was doing more of a ladies' man.
Yeah. Like, what's his name from South Park?
Isaac Hayes. Yeah.
Isaac Hayes. Yeah. That would be a good ChatGPT.
Oh, man.
Anyway, that's not what this is about. But I don't love that you've been captured by them and you're, like, part of the whole Vichy, like, regime. That's troubling. But so today we're going to talk about two works of psychology, 135 years apart.
That's crazy, yeah.
In the main segment, William James, his chapter from The Principles of Psychology, The Stream of Thought. And then right now, for the opening, we're going to talk about a paper entitled Unexpected Events and Pro-Social Behavior, The Batman Effect. Man, how far psychology has fallen.
Oh, I was going to say culmination of all of William James's ideas into this one article.
Yeah. I think so.
Which is like,
yeah,
a Nature journal. I've never heard of this mental health research journal, but it's like part of the Nature publishing group.
Oh, so this wasn't just in Nature.
No, it's like in one of the sub journals. I know. I thought so too. I thought at first. Because it is a nature.com URL.
Yeah.
So this is a single field study done in Milan, where they were interested in, like, what kind of interventions can we do to increase pro-social behavior? So as you well know, as a student of measurement, you need an operational definition of pro-social behavior. So what they picked was giving up your seat for a pregnant woman on a subway ride, like on a train ride. And they're totally theory-driven.
I want to talk about the theories that they...
That's the most absurd part of this, because, like, the findings, it's like, I can't argue with the finding, but why they think they got this is absurd.
It's completely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Well, in one way, it's completely ludicrous, and then another way, it's like, well, yeah.
Okay. So they did this field study where they had... researchers enter, like, board a train. There were other people who were observing in this train, and it was one of two conditions. It was always a woman in a fake pregnancy belly, like a foam belly, looked pregnant, boarding the train, and it had to be like a full train, so there were no seats around. And the measure was, does anybody give up their seat so that she can sit down? Right? The polite, nice thing to do. I assume you would always do this. The manipulation that they chose was having a guy in one of the conditions board the train and be like a few meters away in a Batman suit, just in a full Batman suit, except for the hood. Like, they didn't want to scare anybody, they said, because they were sensitive to the ethical issues of...
Yeah, no, that's very sensitive of them.
No cowl, but yes, cape.
Yeah, he holds the mask, at least in the photo, on his hand, which in some way is a little creepier.
Yeah. So, to quote, the experimental condition mirrored the control, but included an additional element. Another experimenter dressed as Batman entered the train from a different door approximately 3 meters away. There was no interaction between the pretend pregnant woman. Pretend pregnant is the term of art.
It's a hysterical pregnancy. Is that what they're, implying?
For ethical reasons, the full mask was omitted to avoid potentially scaring passengers. The costume nevertheless included the characteristic cape, logo, and pointed cowl, making it easily recognizable. So they had a couple of researchers seated in the trains always. And they like immediately recorded like on their phone or whatever on Qualtrics whether or not somebody gave up their seat. And then if they did, they would go and ask that person after the fact, like, why? Like, did you notice that there was a pregnant woman? Did you notice there was a like a Batman guy?
Yeah.
And so their main finding is that this seemed to work. There was an increase overall from when there was no Batman. The chance that a passenger would give up their spot was 38%, while if Batman was there, the chance increased to 67%. And this was statistically significant.
It feels like, are we back in like 2008 or something like that?
I know.
Is Obama about to be elected, like filling the nation?
Cass Sunstein is in the cabinet.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. Like, in their defense, this is a registered report, which basically means that some journals accept this way of going about doing things. Before you run the study, you submit exactly what you're going to do. So you describe it, like they write the intro, they write their predictions, like everything that they're going to do, and the journal reviews the proposal. And what the journal is doing is pre-committing to publishing the results no matter how they come out. So this is like intended to be a measure to, you know, to prevent against like file drawer effects where, you know, non-significant results don't get published. So like, that's a good thing. So they did that. They get the effect. It's a simple measure. You know, either somebody got up or somebody didn't. It's like a strong effect.
It's in the field. It's not in the lab.
Right. There's no like weird scale of altruism that they used.
I appreciate that. There's no scales. There's no measures like that. Yeah. Although when they talk about in the discussion, they will appeal to a few of those.
Yeah.
But the main finding doesn't depend on it. Just does someone get up or not? Yeah.
So here's the thing. So they're very self-aware that this has the vibe of a social priming experiment. And they're like, maybe that's the effect. But we think that, like, you know, we saw what happened to social priming. It doesn't seem to be a real thing. But like their like theory that they say generated this prediction and then they're using to explain it is this sort of like vague, as you said from the title, unexpected events in pro-social behavior. So they think that what's going on is that there is just an interruption in like the norms of a setting, like in the script that we're used to, and just like the interruption of seeing a random ass guy wearing a Batman suit is enough to like snap people into attention somehow. Like it disrupts, as they say.
Yeah, it makes them more mindful.
Yeah, such events disrupt automatic patterns of attention and behavior, increasing individuals' awareness of their surroundings and the needs of others. So that's what they think is going on, but it's weird because then why Batman? Like,
well, so this is the part where I'm like, in some ways, well, yeah, right? So the idea is that being more mindful in a situation will foster maybe pro-social behavior. And one way to make you more mindful, to get you out of your dream world, or are you listening to a podcast and just zoning out, is to have something novel happen. And then you're like, oh shit, like I'm in, like I notice the world around me right now. Oh, right. This pregnant woman needs a seat. I'll get up. Like I probably didn't even notice her before because I was lost in my world. I think that's the idea. And in some ways that makes sense to me, right?
Yeah, it's less that it doesn't make sense. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things to me. Like I'm I'm not sure why it would encourage mindfulness, unless you just mean by mindfulness, like interrupting your what you're thinking now. Because like I would think you might be just hyper-focused on the weird thing that just happened and not mindful in any...
But haven't you like been in a situation where you're literally like in dreamland, you know, you're not asleep, but you're just lost in your own world. And then something happens, like it could be like a bug stinging you or something like that. You like slap it and it's like, oh, yeah, like I'm back in this space, in this world at this time. Like, I don't know, like no, that kind of makes sense.
That does. Is that mindfulness?
It's not mindfulness like you're trying to cultivate in like certain Buddhist practices. Like
that's the slippage that I worry about, because it makes sense that if you're mindful, you'd be more likely to engage in pro-social behavior. But just to have your attention interrupted, I still have the additional question of why they're helping. They might just be more likely to notice their surroundings.
Yeah.
But why would it encourage them? Is the idea that the default is that you would help if you noticed?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like, if you really are aware that this woman needs a seat, which, yeah, sure, I'm going to get up. Like, yeah, I guess it kind of assumes that you didn't even notice her or you didn't really process her in the way that will relate to the next segment when we talk about like something good.
Yeah, but, right. Yeah. It's actually weirdly relevant and unplanned.
Yeah.
One of the findings that they point out is potentially interesting is that people weren't more likely to say that they recognize the pregnant woman in one condition versus the other. Like at least their explicit acknowledgement didn't change, but who knows why that might be the case. The other thing is, like, you would think though that explanation of interrupting attention could be had with anything, you know.
Why Batman?
Yeah, right. As they point out, like, you've like almost immediately introduced an alternative explanation, which is that like what you're priming is this idea of being some sort of hero and being like moral.
It's almost they like invite that, like like they're building a literature, because it's almost like they built an objection and an alternate explanation into the study. Like they deliberately chose something just so they would have people like testing out other conditions doing that. It feels very like strategic in that way. Like,
I never even thought about that. These sneaky, they're all Italians. Maybe sneaky Italians.
You can't trust them. Not at all.
I would have thought they would like spill olive oil on the train, you know? Like.
Yeah, right. But no, that's not going to start a literature.
So they say, talking about this disrupting hypothesis or theory, they say this suggests a potential mechanism by which novelty and unpredictability foster pro-social behavior, reinforcing theories that link attentional shifts to increased social responsiveness. At the same time, alternative explanations should be considered. For instance, the superhero figure may have increased the salience of cultural values, gender roles, and chivalrous helping norms, in line with research on superhero-related priming. All three of which seem like more plausible accounts to me. But
I like not necessarily to me, but if you knew that, why choose Batman?
I know.
That's what's so ridiculous. So
why not have one more condition where it's just like another thing, you know, another thing that disrupts attention?
I love this also. Therefore, a more parsimonious explanation. I love like to even bring that word into this is just like Occam is spinning in his grave right now. A more parsimonious explanation is that the Batman figure served as a pro-social prime. Yet this explanation, too, should be approached with caution. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Close replications of social priming effects largely failed to reproduce original findings.
Then they say these findings contribute to discussions on how public spaces and social interventions can be designed to encourage kindness and cooperation. What discussions are these, you know? These, if like, unexpected yet non-threatening events can increase mindfulness and pro-social behavior, urban planners, policymakers, and psychologists may consider ways to integrate positive disruptions into daily life. Like, what do you think they have in mind there?
Yeah, obviously, just deploying Batmans. Right. Like, obviously.
Yeah, it's like the beginning of The Dark Knight, where there's just all these Batmans everywhere. I think they have in mind like those, what do they call them? Like the bomb, like dance bombs or whatever, where all of a sudden flash mobs. Yeah.
That's very early aughts of you.
I mean, that's where this paper belongs. Like,
I know, it really does.
Like, don't bail out the banks, Obama. That's going to like completely like torch this country for the next like.
Stop with the drones.
Jesus Christ. You can still have your Martha's Vineyard like estate. just don't know more.
Yeah,
don't.
That was also just hilarious to me as I was thinking about whether they really mean that. Like the thought of scaling something like this was hilarious. Where you'd
be. Yeah. Like, I love the idea that you have these like effect and that you have like which theory is more parsimonious, as if these are fleshed out theories of like human behavior, and we're down to just kind of like, you know, to break the tie, which is more parsimonious. It's just so ridiculous.
Future research should therefore test a range of characters or disruptions varying in both emotional valence and symbolic meaning to clarify the boundary conditions of this effect. The
boundary
Batman effect.
Conditions. So ridiculous. And again, right, like if you think, like, why choose an intervention that would invite this if you didn't want somebody to, you know, like what happens if it's Batgirl?
Yeah, I know.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
What happens if it's a villain?
Well, Wonder Woman. Does Marvel versus DC play a role? It's an open question. I feel like DC is the parsimonious.
Right. Like, I mean, one alternate explanation is this would only work for a DC superhero, but not a Marvel, because people are so sick of the MCU.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know what I also love is the first sentence. Pro-social behavior, voluntary actions that aim to benefit others, has profound implications for societal functioning and individual well-being. And then it like cites, it's like cites. It's just so, it's the emptiest possible thing you could lead a paper off
I'm
of.
Not even sure that's a real sentence. pro-social behavior has implications, I guess. Yeah, no, I know. I didn't even notice that.
Pro-social behavior has profound implications for societal functioning. And it, like, no shit. Like what? How could it not? Like, wait, I don't buy that. We have to look at, hold on. Pro-social behavior and altruism. They cite someone, so I guess it's true.
You know, this is such a short article that they don't have time, but like they get right to it. They're like, there's tons of work on pro-social behavior. For instance, romantic love has been shown to promote pro-social responses. And that's it. Like, that's the lit review.
That's the one, you know? Like, at least give us a quote from a musical or something. Like, you know, kind of.
I know, right?
I want to be, seduced. I want to, like... Take me out to dinner.
Do you think they're working on the Joker, like, next? You know, the Joker control. Well, William James, see what you've done. You opened psychology to be the empirical science that it is. And this is what happened.
I do think it is worth having kind of a meta conversation at some point about like the difference between what James is doing. I mean, I guess we have had this conversation in some way, but because these, you know, I guess they have some parallels, it's such a different way of approaching the subject that it's interesting that it's tilted so far in this direction.
I know. What really they should have had is like a multiple pages long quote of a guy who grew up deaf and blind or whatever.
Now. Well, no, but like, I think this is true of philosophy too. Like, you could find a 2025 paper like in some top journal right now and compare it to like Hume or like William James writing philosophy. And like, I would have the same question, like, what happened, you know?
Yeah.
I think it has to do with the professionalization of the topic, but it's interesting and kind of sad.
Yeah, it's inevitable that something like this would have to happen because of just the increased complexity and division of labor. I'm very curious what William James would think of these kinds of methods. And in fact, like, and we'll get to this in the main topic, because like, I'm not quite sure. In some of these cases where James is writing about some of these phenomena, like, I'm not sure what his method even is. Like, and sometimes I wonder whether he was doing psychology and not just some kind of philosophy.
Saying stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's, okay. So we can talk about that in the next segment. Not to get all serious. All right, we'll be right back to talk about William James's famous chapter, The Stream of Thought.
Keep your mind on your mask, kid. Horror form a classic, it's drastic. Villain hydrochloric acid, splashed it. Pull it, nah, reached and blasted. Pow, 10 stripes on a basket. New York style, wow, cheddar grab easy. It's only entertainment though, when thought out completely. Sad demeanor, could get in the drop and bag cleaner.
master schemer, expert in that arena, puffin' Pasadena. He read the grass was greener. Black Beamer, IH, gyrate, rubbing shoulders with pigs who don't fly straight. Just ate, causing indigestion. Soon regurgitate into profits, no question. Nosy agent sniffing around. Pay attention, you can take that to the bank. Thanks, don't mention. Pleasure's all mine. Ain't mad at y'all. Clear advantage like playing paddleball on Adderall. Be great, that is all.
Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. As you know, we have stopped doing ads because we are the most moral podcast in history, and want to make it clear that this is not an ad. We are teaming up with, as you said, spin-off podcast, Lori Santos's The Happiness Lab. We're teaming up with her and a bunch of other podcasts to join hashtag Pods Fight Poverty. And the goal here is actually to do something super important, to lift three entire villages in Rwanda out of extreme poverty. And we're doing it through the great philanthropy Give Directly, which has been a top four GiveWell charity. And it was always the one that I would choose when I gave to GiveWell when it was available. So, and it's going to give a $1,100 payment, no strings attached. That's a life-changing sum of money in these Rwandan villages.
But Tamler, just giving cash? You might be thinking, what if people waste all that money?
I work hard for all this money and I'm going to give it to them and they'll just waste it.
They're taking our money.
They took our jobs.
No, but seriously, there's a great deal of research showing that these direct cash transfers really do get people out of these situations of extreme poverty. It helps them invest in their futures. When families receive these lump sums of money, they start businesses, they buy livestock to fertilize their farm, they pay off school fees. There's even research showing that these cash transfers can cut infant mortality by half. And, you know, if you're economically minded, every dollar that we give creates $2.50 in wealth in the local economy. So even people nearby in the wider community can benefit. It's a small amount for us, but it really is, like you said, life-changing for the people who receive it.
Yeah, and if you give a donation to at Give Directly, that'll get a 50% boost today. I think this goes through the end of the month thanks to Giving Multiplier. So go to givedirectly.org/wizards. And this is something that we were always very high up in GiveWell donations. It'd be very cool if you could represent the podcast and give to a truly great philanthropy.
Yeah, and let me just end by saying, I would really like it if we could beat the Happiness Lab in number of donations.
Yes.
I mean, it's not a competition. I'm just giving us some motivation.
If we could give like the spinoff podcast, like if we could show them that they are a spinoff and that we are the flagship podcast, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, so thank you, everybody. GiveDirectly.org/wizards. Make your donation, and they will appreciate it. And we're still going to take the time that we normally take this part of the episode to thank you for all of your support. We really appreciate it. We love hearing from you. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us, verybadwizards@gmail.com. You can tweet to us at Tamler, at Pease, or at verybadwizards. You can go join in some discussion on Reddit at reddit.com/r/verybadwizards for the unofficial Very Bad Wizards Reddit. You can find us on Instagram. And if you find it in your heart, you can give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, maybe even a review there or on Spotify. We very much appreciate it. And if you would like to help us in more tangible ways, you can go to our support page, verybadwizards.com, and click on the support page. You'll see the various ways you can help us out. You can buy some swag, you can donate to us via PayPal, or you can become part of our Patreon supporter family. And if you do, you'll see there's a number of tiers at $2 a month. You get our ad-free episodes, so the whole back catalog without ads. You also get access to my little beat compilations. I have 9 of them. I Yeah, 9 of them. If you join us at the $5 per month and up level, you get access to all of our bonus content, including our listening to our monthly Ask Us Anything series, our entire Deadwood podcast series, The Ambulators, our podcast with Paul Bloom on Severance, The Reintegrators, all of our back catalog of bonus episodes where we talk about various movies, TV shows, and sometimes bring on guests. And maybe just most excitingly, if that's a word, for us, our latest series, our now ongoing series on The Odyssey, on Homer's Odyssey. We put out our episode on Odyssey parts 1 and 2 for everybody to listen. And now we're just going to continue going. We're about to record episodes, an episode on books 3 and 4. Really excited about it. It's an easy read. Follow along with us. Join us if you haven't. It's like a book club, but you know, like a good one where you get to chime in on the episodes and tell us what you think about what we're saying or what you read. So you get that with $5 a month and $5 a month and up. At $10 and up, you get all of that. You get to vote on an episode topic that we do these polls a couple times a year. You get access to our 5-part Brothers Karamazov series. You get access to a couple of lecture series, Tamler on Plato Symposium and some of my intro psych lectures. And at $20 and up, you get access to us in the form of asking us anything. You get to be a questioner. And once a month, we answer those questions. We release them on video for the $20 and up club. But everybody from the bonus tiers and up gets access to our answers. So thank you, everybody. As the holiday season approaches, it's just an extra excuse to communicate our appreciation for you guys, for the community you've built, for listening to us and for putting up with us. We really appreciate it. Okay, now for the main topic, William James's Stream of Thought. So this is one of the chapters in his famous, influential 2-volume Principles of Psychology, published in 1890. And I think, Tamla, I think this is maybe his most famous idea, at least culturally. This might be the most influential, even though it's not clear what what exactly the influence is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think people tend to associate, like, the whole stream of consciousness idea, which I think might be fair, like the stream of thought as opposed to like a succession of like atomistic ideas. Like that is something that this does endorse and, you know, it rejects the atomistic theory. That's a big influence. But it feels like people attribute to this the whole idea of stream of consciousness in art.
In art, right.
And stream of consciousness, in prose style because of his brother, Henry James. So, I think it has this secondary influence, but that might not be earned, I think.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's right. So just like a broad strokes outline of what he's doing in this chapter, he is disagreeing with, I think, this strand of thought that still exists to this day, which I really want to talk about, that the way to try to understand consciousness is by looking at the individual parts of subjective experience. So sometimes people talk about, you know, you have all these individual sensations. Like, isn't it a mystery how they all combine into being this one sense of subjective experience? And he seems to just be arguing that it's a mistake to even start thinking about consciousness or thought as atomistic.
Yeah. And like, I think he's responding specifically to a strain in philosophical inquiry from John Locke, this idea of simple ideas that get built up to form more complex ideas. So the way we would get like a forest is to have a simple idea, I don't know, of bark and of leaves and of branches. And that gives us a complex idea of a tree. And then we can build from that out. And that's the thing that he's rejecting here.
Yeah, and that makes sense because there is a particular kind of psychology that is like this associationistic, like very empirical view that the way that you ever get complex ideas is by experiencing the more simple ones and then combining them. And he just seems to think that this is a wrong approach if what you're trying to do is understand consciousness.
Which they are, so.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing I want to talk about, though, because I think that there is a way in which if what you're trying to understand is how consciousness gets built, it doesn't seem that wrongheaded to try to think about the components, you know?
Yes.
But that's different than, I guess, explaining the nature of subjective experience.
Oh, I see. So you're saying like that could work, you know, maybe if you were doing brain science or some kind of functionalist cognitive science or something like that. But you think he's doing this more phenomenologically, trying to capture like the actual experience.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Right. So it's holistic in experience. But part of me thinks, well, but it has to be atomistic in some way. You know, but
why does part of you think that?
Because that's just how things work. Like, you literally do have different sensory organs that are inputting different pieces of information, right? Like, it has to get processed somehow. That it presents itself as a holistic experience, I think, is true. And maybe he's right that we're misguided to think that the way to understand subjective experience is to understand the components. But your brain is putting together a whole bunch of different sensations. Like, that seems kind of trivially true.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know. Like, when you're starting to talk about how the brain and consciousness, like how that all works, I don't see why you have to be reductionistic about it. And it could be holistic in a way that we don't understand, or it could be, you know, atomistic, at least at the level before it becomes accessible to us as conscious experience. But I don't know why you necessarily have to think it must be atomistic in some sense. I mean, like, we have neurons and we have, but that's, I don't know. Like,
yeah,
that's,
well, I mean, we should get, like, let me finish maybe giving the broad overview because I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay.
So, like, the chapter is divided into five sections, each of which makes a specific claim about this experience of consciousness. So the first is that it is streamlike. It's continuous, it's fluid, there's no gaps. The other one is that consciousness is always personal. It's always about you. Mm-hmm. It's always your consciousness. And, you know, he has some interesting discussion there that I was wondering what you would think about, like where he seems to think it's just obviously true that the you is always there.
You were right that I want to talk about that. He calls it one of the most absolute breaches found in nature, this my stream of thought and my consciousness versus your stream of thought and your consciousness.
Yeah, the biggest breach is the difference between yours and mine.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, the most absolute breaches in all of nature, he says. So,
which is why, by the way, like, not to get ahead of ourselves, but why I wouldn't think that you would be so opposed to me challenging his view that it is always best understood as a holistic subjective experience and not basically understand some of this as components, because when you understand it as components, you can start seeing that it is perhaps the illusion of unified selfness that is going on here, right?
But I think that's a separate, that's orthogonal. Like,
yeah, and I don't. So, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
So but we'll get to that.
Okay,
yeah. So
that's right. He also says that one of his big points is that consciousness is always changing. So, you know, he invokes Heraclitus, you never step into this same stream twice.
Yeah.
You never have the same experience twice, even though you think that you might. You think that every time you smell that rose, it's the same experience, but is, you know, he says, it's a silly thing to assume because you are a different person each time you smell it. There's all kinds of background conditions that differ both in your mind and in the world. All that stuff he thinks is illusory.
He also says there's no way to determine that because, like, the person is not a good judge of it. So, like, it does seem kind of hopeless to even answer that question.
Right.
Yeah.
Then he says consciousness is one of the primary features for him is that it's driven by selective attention. So he thinks that experience of consciousness is motivated so much by what you're paying attention to, whether it be your specific thoughts or some feature of your environment.
Guy in a Batman suit.
Exactly. So two people might be sort of like having the same sensory, like the same photons, the same molecules of smell, the same waves of sound are hitting them, but they have fundamentally different experiences because one person is paying attention to some feature of it that the other person is not paying attention to.
Yeah, he has a great line about this. He says, the mind is at every stage a theater of simultaneous possibilities.
Yeah.
Because the data that we take in underdetermines the experience we're going to have. And so, like, it really just depends on what we're attending to. And we're always excluding some things and putting in others. And so we could have, like, a second before, like, a completely different experience than the one that we end up having just because of this tiniest little alteration in our attention.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and this like mechanism of attention ends up playing a big part in Will, which we already talked about, I guess, the chapter on Will.
We just talked about the chapter on attention. We never did the Will.
We didn't do Will? No. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So, yeah. Another thing he says is that consciousness is always appearing to deal with objects that are independent of the self. So he makes this point about like, you think that what you're perceiving is the object. You confuse your subjective experience for the object itself,
yeah.
Which is almost like, he's almost getting Kantian there. Yeah. That you never are really experiencing the object. You're just sort of thinking that you're
just idea. Yeah. I think he's just being an idealist, or at least he's leaning in that direction of like what we have is the experience. It's an inference to assume that it's the actual thing. But actually, when you think of all the different variations of all the different ways we could experience that thing, yeah, I think you're right. Maybe Kantian is right. Like there is something there that's causing you to have this experience. But the idea that your experience matches the thing is like far-fetched.
Yeah. And he has a nice little passage there where he sort of refers to it as triangulating. So like we infer that the object is the same object because we're triangulating our experience at like two different times, or my experience and your experience like are similar enough that we're like, oh yeah, so we're both looking at that thing.
Right. That's the inference that we make as just purely just based on the fact that other people are experiencing it too.
So I think like that's a starting point to dive in. Like I was trying to say, think to myself, how would I summarize what, like what's his thesis here? And I think that the best that I was getting at is just this somehow an anti-reductionistic view, like a very holistic view of consciousness.
Yeah. And a very much of a, like the river, the stream, it's always flowing. It never stops. And it has all different flavors and all different varieties, but it's just constantly going.
And it's my stream and you have your stream and never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, it's like their river banks are high. And so one river and, you know, he would change on that, you know, like as he got more, a little more mystical later in his later work and varieties of religious experience and then the radical empiricism stuff, like he would bend on that part, which I think he should, because I don't think that's the most compelling part of this, as you know, you might, but maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. So let's,
I did want to say though, that when I was reading this, I was thinking, well, like we're talking, that's us crossing streams.
Yeah, but we are across, and maybe we shouldn't cross the streams.
We shouldn't have crossed
but the you know, like I see what he's saying. I still am in my experience, and even though I'm saying a word and you're hearing that word, we're having different experiences in that. Yeah. But so we'll talk about that because that's really right at the beginning of the chapter. Did you want to say more about how you were questioning the method here, and is it even psychology?
Yeah. So as I was reading this, you know, across the principles, the two volumes, there's so much. There's all kinds of style of argumentation and building a case, and some are more empirical than others. This one, what struck me was that a lot of what he's saying about how psychologists might be getting this wrong. So we mentioned one target, the people who view like consciousness as this atomistic, like the it's just the sum of these individual parts. Another one is he's like throws some shade on introspectionists.
Does he? Where does he do that?
So he's not taking aim at the school, but he is saying a lot of people get so misguided because they are introspecting and they think it can't be any other way, when in fact they're just like fooling themselves. And through a lot, I was thinking like, but he's relying a lot on his own introspection about the stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
And so even when I agree, like I had, I would sometimes take a step back and say like, am I agreeing because like he's actually making convincing arguments, or because like I'm just convinced of what he's saying? Because it's hard, as you were pointing out earlier, for some of this stuff, it's like unclear what it would even mean to have evidence for like a competing view.
It surprises me a little to hear you say that, because the, like, I remember there was something you said a few episodes back, but it was one of these studies where maybe it was one about how visual illusions may or may not be more effective across cultures. You know, like, do people experience them differently across cultures depending on their ecological conditions? And what you said was, that like the great thing about like cognitive science when it deals with perception, especially visual perception, is most of the experiments, you don't like have to run studies. You just show it to a person. You show them like, what do you see? And there it is. Like, you don't need an experiment. You don't need to do linear regressions. You don't need to pre-register anything. You just show it to people. That's what I feel like he's doing here is like, yeah, like this is what's going on as I am characterizing it for me. But he, you know, I think it's compelling because it's going on for us too. And the way he describes it, like the way he describes, if you can't think of a person's name, but you can get like a fuzzy outline of the of a name, like a blurry fringe of the name, and you immediately know if somebody says the wrong name that it's not that. It's just like, yeah, that's a good way of describing the exact same experience that I have. So like, I don't know, like that seems to me, it's not as clear cut as the visual illusion, and it does depend on people actually sharing the experience that he's talking about. But I still think that's psychology to the extent that that's a division, a real, you know, demarcation.
Yeah, maybe it's not right for me to say it's not so much psychology. It's just, I find that he's conflicted in the way that he's reporting some of this stuff, where he takes his experience as a solid piece of evidence for why some feature of the mind is obvious. But then other people describing their mental experience, he thinks they're clearly wrong. And this is why I wanted to get to the thing, like where when he doubles down hard on like this unified sense of self as being the center of conscious experience, doesn't it seem to you that like that needs to be defended more than just simply stipulating that that's the most obvious?
Yeah. Okay. That's a good example, because you know that I'm going to probably be sympathetic with what you're saying here. So let's go to it. So he says, each of these minds keeps its own thoughts to itself. There is no giving or bartering between them. No thought even comes in direct sight of a thought in another personal consciousness but its own. Absolute insulation, irreducible pluralism is the law. It seems as if the elementary psychic fact were not thought or this thought or that thought, but my thought. Every thought being owned. The breaches between such thoughts are the most absolute breaches in nature. Everyone will recognize this to be true so long as the existence of something corresponding to the term personal mind is all that's insisted on, without any particular view of its nature being implied. And then finally, the universal conscious fact is not feeling and thoughts exist, but I think, I feel. No psychology at any rate, this is the strongest claim, no psychology at any rate can question the existence of personal selves. Yeah, this is exactly the thing that I think he kind of changed his mind to a significant extent about. But I don't have a problem with it methodologically, because it's like, no, I don't think it has to be like that. Like, now you're not describing what I think is essentially true about my experience. And so, yeah, that's okay too, you know?
Well, right. But if that's what he's hanging his claim on, it seems that like, well, there are the ones that you agree with as also features of your conscious experience, and they're the ones that you disagree with. But it's like, what, like, what's the truth?
It's not, it's not agree like we're having opinions. It's like this idea of whether he's capturing what I take to be my experience or not. Right. And so like when it doesn't work, it doesn't work, like, you know, but methodologically it seems fine. It's like, look, I'm going to say these things. It will either capture your experience or it won't. And it will be compelling or not compelling, like based on how well it does that.
No, but he's not saying like, let me toss this out here and see if this resonates with your experience. He's saying no psychology can question the existence of personal
selves.
Well,
that's,
like,
that's
these
ridiculous.
Are strong. Like, yeah, I mean, he is claiming a universality of what consciousness is based on, in many cases, like, and this was like, I would think that that would cause you to say, okay, well, maybe some of the things that do resonate with me, I should not take as confidently as he's presenting, because there might be other people who don't have that experience. So if the claim is universality, which I think is very clearly what he's trying to say, then it seems like not a great method to achieve. Like,
but see, I guess, and I agree, like that claim, like no psychology at any rate can question the existence of personal selves, like that's too strong, but I don't mind him throwing it out there. Like, look, yeah, what I'm looking for in a William James chapter is to try to learn something that might capture experience or might synthesize certain experiences along with other stuff that I've noticed or read or like. So to give this vivid description that comes from his own phenomenology and to see to what degree that reflects my own and can even make sense of certain things I'm puzzled about or confused about or don't see how they're connected. And even this is like kind of useful where I disagree to figure out exactly how or why I disagree. Like I find all of that super useful, whether or not.
But like, I'm not saying that it's not useful or interesting or insightful, like in the same way that Freud is interesting and useful and insightful. Like I'm simply pointing out that I think that the certainty with which he's presenting this is a feature of what, like, I think his goal is to explain a universal truth. So when you say, like, it doesn't bother me, like, I believe you, like, it doesn't bother, but like, I think that his goal is to capture a universal thing. And the way that he's doing it through introspection and making that claim seems to me not to be on the same, like, ground as when, say, he's describing, you know, studies on perception where like people can tell the difference between two different stimuli that are given to you, right? Like that's like just a different thing.
But that's also like, that's something that's by nature more intersubjective, whereas this is something by nature that's completely and totally subjective, which is kind of part of his point. And so like, there's no perfect way of approaching something like consciousness and streams of thought. Like you have to approach it in this other way. Now I agree, like the rhetoric, but I like to me, this is a problem with rhetoric. No, this is a problem with rhetoric. He's saying it too strongly and confidently and with too much certainty. And he's presenting maybe his aims in a way that I would think should be much less ambitious in terms of the universality of the claims. But that to me is a rhetorical problem. Like I like the actual method to me is much more, and even Freud, like Freud, I have to like take leaps and buy something. With this, I don't have to do that. Like this either captures my experience and makes sense of something that I'm confused about or it doesn't. Like I don't have to like do any right. kind of leaps of faith when I look at this.
Yeah. Fair enough. Like and we're approaching this differently. Like, but I feel like I'm taking him at face value for his claims. And so for you to say, like, I don't mind, sometimes he says wrong things and sometimes he says right things, or sometimes he says things that don't resonate, or sometimes he's being too strong. I'm just taking him at face value for saying these things as universal features of consciousness. Like in that sense, we just agree. You just don't think it's as problematic, right? I don't think that this is a turn of phrase to try to convince me. I think that he's making a strong claim, and the evidence that he's using to back up that strong claim isn't enough. And so to say, well, like, that's fine because some of them I'll agree with because they match my experience and some I'll disagree with because they don't match my experience is not to take William James's claims seriously.
I mean, it's not to take the literally. Like, it's to take him still seriously, yeah. though.
Right. Yeah, I guess I don't understand why the charitable nature of, like, if somebody in
like
that nature
dude,
paper made
know?
A strong... Don't you like me? Fucking like, take me seriously.
I think your rhetoric yeah. is a little off. Here,
so this is, but like, I agree with everything you're saying about like that he's using a very straightforward way of introspecting about the like what consciousness is like. I actually agree. I actually probably agree way more than you do that there is irrefutably a self.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so that much I agree with. I just think that the burden... It just can get slippery because my concern is that later on, I think he does use just as strong a language for things that you resonate with and that you might not notice that he's using that strong language. And somebody might say, actually, I feel like maybe Locke was like, no, I do feel like I'm experiencing eight different things and somehow bringing them together in my mind.
Yeah. And if he does, like then either, you know, he's lying, he's different, you know, like I'm somehow defective that I can't break it down. Like he could, you know, it could be anything. I just think with something like personal subjective experience or phenomenology, it's like you have to come at it somewhat obliquely because there's no way for us to know. There's no way for us to know, like, if your experience is like the same as my experience. There's just no way. So you have to come at this. There's going to be like a kind of almost essential deadly flaw with any methodology, right? Like, and you could be too reductionistic and just say, well, but the neurons here, this part of the amygdala is activated. And then it's like, okay, but now we're not talking about experience anymore. We're making inferences.
Right.
I think that's just the nature of this particular topic. Whereas like Habit or something like that, which is like an incredible chapter here, it's a little easier for us to get at a more objective picture.
Right. So I agree. And like all I think really I'm saying is that he thinks that he's building a objective science of subjectivity. Like he's putting all these chapters together as a theory of psychology. But, you know, I agree, though, that there's no better way to do it. Like there's not, I just wouldn't be so short.
I might be being a little pragmatist about it, but even when you say that, I kind of think that just means he's feels very strongly about certain, you
know. Right. Yeah. Maybe yeah. That's maybe. The other thing, though, you know, bringing up the brain, this is where I was like, I think you are giving him a pass because you like him, because I was doing it too, because some of the stuff that he talks about where he's like, obviously the brain is like this. And so that's how we know that you don't have the same experience because the brain is constantly changing. I was like, we wouldn't give that a pass if somebody made that
argument. I selectively I honestly didn't like, I kind of like didn't process a lot of that stuff. Like, I think I kind of knew that I wasn't going to like it. Oh, the graph. Like yeah, like that's the thing. Like with the graphs, and then when it became three dimensional, I was just like, I'm not even gonna try to figure out what he's saying.
All right, I think we have an understanding about what's going on. Yeah, because
he's earned a little charity though.
Yeah, he has.
More than the nature author. Did we even say the name?
No, it was a lot of Italian names. Okay. Sorry, guys.
Don't whack us.
I feel like Milan is not Sicily, you know. So, but there is a lot in here that I think is so right about attention. Like that thing that you were saying about the feeling of trying to think of a name.
Yeah.
Like I think that's a great example of the emptiness of a conscious experience that is nonetheless clearly different from another empty experience, right? So he's saying, I'm trying to think of a name in one case and I can't think of it.
Yeah.
In another case, I'm trying to think of a different name and I can't think of it. Those two things are very different. Like you kind of get this like vague, this fringe sense that of what that name might be, even though you don't have it, but you know it when it's wrong. Like there is something about those empty states that I think is
so interesting. Yeah. He says there's like a psychic overtone of a feeling.
It's so good. Yeah. Did you get that? That's like the musical metaphor because it's such a good metaphor because he's saying like, okay, if you pluck a string on a guitar, like an A or whatever, I don't remember what the strings are. You play the note on the guitar. That guitar has not just that tone, the main tone. It has a bunch of overtones. So like harmonic tones. So there are identifiably like three or four higher notes.
Right.
That same note played on a flute. It's the same note. Like they're both an A, like in the same octave. But the flute tone has different overtones. And that's why we can identify like why one has a timbre that's different from the other one. And to say that like, yeah, we're both thinking of the same exact thing, but like there are all these other features that play into what makes your thought, and my thought, my thought. And I, like, that just seems so right.
It seems so right. And also like, it's not that I don't get that because of that, like our streams have to be different. Like, does it follow if it's a continuous stream? I don't think so. But I could see why you would think it follows that if this is a continuous stream, then they can't cross because you're always going to be coming at something from a different perspective. So you won't ever like overlap exactly.
Right. And I think this is like a now an interesting puzzle because the fact that our streams will never cross, that huge gap in what, you know, like he says, Peter and Paul go to bed together. They don't, one doesn't wake up with the other person's memories. Like,
yeah, that's another great thing. First of all, why are Peter and Paul?
I imagine that it was Peter Salovey and Paul Blue and that they secretly had an affair. And so there's the intersubjective thing where it's like, like just in terms of access epistemology, like I'll never really know what you're experiencing. But then you experiencing the thing yesterday and you experiencing it today is substantively different. But nonetheless, you have the illusion that it was the same.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting feature of consciousness where our stream from time one to time two has this strong sense that it's like the same.
Yes. And this is a thing that like when we were doing Funes, that's the thing that he doesn't have. Like,
he can't abstract.
Like it's probably actually like about this debate right here.
Yeah.
So he's, I want to talk about this. So Peter and Paul wake up in the same bed and recognize that they've been asleep. And then they make a connection with one of the two streams of thought, obviously theirs, right? Like, and then he says, so the past thought of Peter is appropriated by the present Peter alone. He may have a knowledge, and even a correct one, of what Paul's last drowsy state of mind were as he sank into sleep. They're very close.
This is so gay. This is so-
it's like, yeah, it's very like boarding school in Britain.
I don't know. It just feels good.
But it is an entirely different sort of knowledge from that which he has of its own states. And this is a great little thing. He says he remembers his own states while he only conceives Paul's.
Yeah.
Remembrance is like direct feeling. Its object is suffused with a warmth and intimacy to which no object of mere conception ever attains. So like when I remember something that I did, it has this warmth. It's suffused with warmth and intimacy, whereas I might know exactly what you experienced, and I might be right that that was your last thought or whatever before you in the same bed as me drifted off to sleep, but like it won't be suffused with that. Like it's, this is one of those examples where it's like, what do you mean by warmth and intimacy and immediacy? But I also think that sounds right. Like my memories do have something like subjective warmth.
It seems so obvious as to be weird to point it out, but it is true. Like, it's just like, I don't know what's going on there. But, you know, and he's talking about this in the context of disruptions of consciousness, where he says, so he's arguing that it's continuous, but he says, of course, you have some disruptions. So like you fall asleep, that's a disruption. But when you wake up, you pick right where you left off and you know that it's your consciousness.
I was surprised he didn't do, he says it's just inferences that you know you're asleep. But I thought that was kind of interesting, this idea that the way we connect with it is through some feeling of intimacy, even though like intimacy, I don't know, like I know what he means, but
right. This is another thing that I really like about this chapter and probably other chapters, but I haven't read those in a while, where he says a couple of times that our vocabulary is too ill-suited.
Yeah.
Like he gives these warnings that you shouldn't rely on the words that you have to describe psychology to like accurately capture what the psychology is.
Yeah.
We just don't have words sometimes. And like, that's the sense that I got here where it's like, yeah, call it warm. Like he's really just saying it's mine, but like trying to find other ways of saying it, you know?
Yeah. But I think like it does a little bit more than just say it's mine. Like the warmth thing like captures something in the same way that, you know, when he tries to talk about the tingle of a word, you know, like when you hear a word, it has a certain tingle, or it attributes some value to it, or an odor, like, you know, like something, you know, like I think like some of these are evocative of the feeling, but yeah, of course it can't fully capture it because it seems like it's past language at that point.
Yeah, right. It is interesting, though, that our language can push us to the limits of like trying to understand these things, and why, you know, that gap between consciousnesses that he refers to, language is the one thing that like gets us even close to bridging it, you know. And so a good artist, you do feel like a reading the way that some people write or film, obviously, you're getting just a glimpse of somebody else's subjectivity in a way that would be impossible otherwise.
Right. And especially certain, like if like a Tarkovsky film, you feel like you're entering not really, but vicariously through somebody else's consciousness because of how personal it is. Yeah.
Do you know, by the way, talking about his mystical stuff in reading up a little bit on this chapter, I learned his father was like a mystic.
Like an actual mystic?
Yeah. Like he was a follower of Emanuel Swedenborg. Who was this like Swedish mystic who was like very influential. He was like a scientist, like theologian and mystic. And so both William and Henry like grew up in this household where things like the conscious experience and that feeling of, you know, all of those, like that subjectivity, that was all just part of what they would have grown up in.
Yeah, that was the air they breathed.
Yeah. And so it makes sense that like these mysteries for him are like the most interesting things to focus on.
Yeah. And I do think like when he got into the later like radical empiricism, he was just more open to that stuff.
Yeah. Maybe he experienced his own replication crisis like sometime in like 1895. And then just retreated into philosophy.
He was like, I could try to pre-register my thoughts. That would help.
He didn't know how awesome that would be. He had no idea.
That hadn't been invented yet. He didn't know how that would just solve everything.
There were no Daniel Lackens or Dutch school of like wagging their finger at him.
So do we have, like, I feel like we haven't talked about everything, right?
No, yeah. We're doing this very stream of consciousness
in the spirit of the thing. But one thing is, it's just, there's just so much good, like, so just this idea where he's talking about selective attention and how much we underplay how different it is for, like, you know, like an experience of both of us, like on a subway car, like we could be sitting next to each other. We're having completely different experiences, but we don't, we always think maybe we have some, you know, there's some difference, but we're basically looking at the same stuff. And so this is the way he describes it. He says, let four men make a tour in Europe. One will bring home only picturesque impressions, costumes and colors, parks and views and works of architecture, pictures and statues. To another, all this will be non-existent, and distances and prices and populations and drainage arrangements, doors and window fastenings, and other useful statistics will take their place. A third will give a rich account of the theaters, restaurants, and public balls, and not beside, while the fourth will perhaps have been so wrapped up in his own subjective broodings as to tell little more than a few names of places through which he passed. Each has selected out of the mass of presented objects which suited his private interest and has made his experience thereby. That's just such a great description of just how different these things can be. And I'm sure it's true to a large extent.
It is kind of crazy that, like, this is almost certainly the case, and we have zero idea what another person's experience is, but we have these ways of describing them to each other where we're pretty sure we're kind of experiencing similar things, you know? And this is actually ties into another thing I wanted to talk about, which I think you touched on in bringing up Funes the Memorious. He has a section here where he's talking about language, and, you know, he's very prescient discussion of, is language necessary for thought? And, you know, he seems to think, no, you...
Thought is prior to language.
Thought is prior to language. But he says that what words are doing, what verbal symbols are doing, is they're symbols that are standing in for a variety of different experiences. So he says, the verbal symbol horse, which stands for all our experiences of horses, serves all the purposes of thought without recalling one of the images clustered in the perception of horses. Just as the sight of a horse's form serves all the purposes of recognition without recalling the sound of its neighing or its tramp, the qualities as an animal of draft, and so forth. So we are abstracting and turning all of this collection of sensations and experiences, like congealing it into a verbal symbol and then exchanging it with each other. And like we're, by some measure, we know what we're experiencing. Like, oh yeah, have you seen a horse? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever, and like, you know, sometimes that connection is more solid than others. Like sometimes you can like see that you're just not on the same page. Like you can't, like, I think this is, I have this experience sometimes talking to people where, you know, like halfway into the conversation, I can tell that we're not connecting. And it's just like that thing that language is often effective at doing isn't going to work as well in this case. Like, I think, like, you know, we just did Kafka, A Hunger Artist. I feel like a lot of Kafka characters aren't connecting with the people around them, you know? Like, that's something I think that comes up in art a lot is, you know, when this works and when this really doesn't. And you're talking about different things and the words mean such different things that it's just, it's not productive.
Right. You know, when he's talking about this stuff, he's trying to use this metaphor of algebra, which is kind of weird.
But I think to get the kind of curvature of the whole thing.
Where it's like they're standing in as symbols and we all recognize them. And it does, like you saying that about the alienation of the Kafka character. And we had this discussion about, like, isn't it like kind of ironic that that alienation communicated through the story actually connected so many people to him? And sometimes I think the people who have that severe alienation, who think that nobody else understands them, they're more right probably than we are, right? Yes. We have this weird feature of our social selves that makes us relate to each other in a way that we're all, it's kind of pretense that comes second nature to us to just like be like, yeah, I've totally felt that. Like, yeah. You know, and every once in a while you get this real raw, like realization that actually, man, we might be completely.
Yeah. It's like, wait, I might be in a Lynch movie right now. Like, yeah. Like we're having a conversation, but we're like in different yeah. worlds.
That was cool.
That's good. Like, this is why I like this stuff. And that's, you know, like you could try to run an experiment to demonstrate this, but like that would just be a Rube Goldberg way of arriving at the same insight, I think, like capturing same insight.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, I agree that like these big points would be hard to, but, you know, like there is a lot of stuff that he uses to build some of these points. So another thing that I liked in this discussion was when he's building this thing that like we never experience the same thing twice and that we confuse the object for the experience. Like we think that we're experiencing the same thing because we've just tied it to the object, even though we're experiencing radically different things. He there talks about some of the research on perception and how we're under the illusion that like when we see the same thing twice, that we're having the same experience. So the example I think he uses is a shadow in a painting.
Yeah.
But it, you know, there is these visual illusions where, and I show this to my intro psych class, if you have like a painting of a black and white checkered tile and there's light falling on one side and shadow on the other side, what you will realize is that if you isolate the black tile bathed in light and the white tile under shadow, it's exactly the same color. So like it's emitting the same exact shade.
Right.
It's just that the context
right.
makes us really think that we're seeing different colors.
But in the painting, it would be the same paint color.
In the
color.
Painting, like the artist has, exactly. Yeah. The artist has to use some like gray to like communicate both of them.
Right.
In the real world, obviously, like, but the light hitting our eyes is actually exactly the same. And we think that they are actually different tiles.
And if I'm not wrong, I think this is in service of like arguing against the atomistic view in favor of the stream view, because if it's atoms, then there's no reason to think that we can't experience the same ones. But he just thinks that's a useful fiction. That's like a way to communicate that. So he says, no doubt it's often convenient to formulate the mental facts in an atomistic sort of way and to treat the higher states of consciousness as if they were all built out of unchanging simple ideas. You know, like you could think like colors. It's convenient often to treat curves as if they were composed of small straight lines and electricity and nerve force as if they were fluids. But in the one case, as in the other, we must never forget we're talking symbolically and that there is nothing in nature to answer our words. A permanently existing idea or Vorstellung, which makes its appearance before the footlights of consciousness at periodic intervals, is as mythological an entity as the Jack of Spades.
As I was reading that, I had my cards in my hand and I was like, but I have a Jack of Spades right here.
So it's not, how is that? I actually wondered what he meant by that. Like, is there a Jack of Spades in myth?
I don't know.
I just like, is there a Jack of Spades in the tarot
There's
deck?
Not. No. Yeah.
Did you get your tarot deck, by the way?
Yeah.
Have you been
No, I don't play with them. I'm an acolyte. I need like a mentor. Yeah. I need like a wizard to show me how to use them to divine. But yeah, I think you're right. He's using this in the service of arguing against the atomistic view. And I think that's closely tied to me to that what he's saying about words as verbal symbols. I think we are just abstracting and we're saying, yeah, that tile is a black tile and that tile is a black tile and that black tile is a black tile. And we're extracting some commonality to it. And then we're sort of like, maybe even in memory, we just think it was all the same. Whereas somebody like Funes the Memorious could never
do that.
He's only ever seen three different tiles. Yeah. They're all different color. You know?
Different dogs from 5:44 in 2 seconds to 5:44 in 3 seconds.
Right.
Oh,
God. That story gives me anxiety.
It does.
So when you were talking earlier about like how at the very beginning you were saying like you were getting at me for thinking that brain science would have anything to do with this, I want to see if this is a way of saying what I was trying to say that makes more sense to you. So this is in the service of maybe why it might make sense to talk about atomistic experiences. When people like who study consciousness are trying to make sense of what's going on, they sometimes talk about the binding problem, right? And the binding problem is, how is it that what we know, like take an object, you have like the solidity of it, the color of it, the texture of it, we are having all of those things. Like, all of those things are features of that object. Yeah. They're combining somehow into a unified, like, perception that, of that object. How does the brain, or maybe even the mind, like, actually get from here's the information about the light, here's information about the touch, here's information about the shape or whatever. How does it cohere? Like, and that seems like it is not just, that's not being reductionistic and it's not confusing brain science for psychology. It's trying to build a theory for how we get holistic perception, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I'm not in any way an expert or even a kind of a lay amateur when it comes to, like, being familiar with a lot of that research. But, like, if you're trying to kind of see how the brain can build the model, like, maybe predictive processing views are one that would be able to maybe explain how a brain could build models of these things and act in a way that is, you know, influenced by those models. Like, it's going to be still a leap. There's still that hard problem of how does that get presented, you know, in this thick way to a consciousness with this kind of subjective character. So I'm still, like, thinking the Nagel point or the, you know, like, the hard problem idea still that, like, I don't know if it can do that, but it might do this other thing, which is probably very useful, of seeing how, like, an organism could build models of, you know, incorporating all this data from the world into actionable behavior.
Yeah, right. I guess where I was trying to go with that is saying, like, I think that there are psychologists that would be interested in understanding the features of sensation, and that they're not making a mistake by pointing out that color is a thing and that's, you know, shape is a thing and texture is a thing. It's not consciousness for sure. But it's also not psychology, if that makes sense. It's like a, so, you know, the question of how children identify objects, like, how do children know that there is, like, a ball on the floor and that it's not all one thing, like a ball on a floor? And they use these different cues, like the shape of the ball and the common movement and all that stuff. Like, so the question is, like, how do we know that one thing is one thing and then experience that thing as a thing? And it's not obvious how.
I'm not a Platonist about, like, what you call psychology and what you don't. I'm happy to call that psychology. What I think James is worried about with this stuff in its very kind of proto state is that it won't capture the stream aspect of it. It's going to be, like, almost methodologically necessary that it's atomistic. And, like, that's not the character of experience from his view.
Yeah. And it really is two different. I mean, there is the question of how our minds get to a conscious state, and then there is the question of what is the conscious state that we are at. And I guess that's the division being made here. And it would be a mistake, I think that because we sense texture and because we see light and because we hear sound, that our consciousness is somehow in consciousness. Like, trying to bring them all
assembling
together.
Assembling them.
Yeah, that would be a weird thing.
And even just calling it and separating it into sound is distinct from sight, which is distinct. I mean, one of the things you get with meditation is you feel like you can start hearing your body sensations or something like that. Yeah. Like, the senses become more porous. So it becomes even maybe more holistic even than what James is describing. And, like, so again, like, language is always going to bring this additional element. But that's really not to cast any skepticism on the usefulness of some of that research, because I think it obviously couldn't be, like, the child development stuff and the, like, stuff on babies that Paul does, like, clearly that's explaining something important and interesting. But I think, like, the, it might be, like, methodologically kind of impossible to capture certain elements of the continuous nature of consciousness and the thick nature of consciousness.
Yeah. And I think that's why the binding problem is mysterious, because there is some stage where you have to make this leap from whatever is going on with the brain into whatever's going on with consciousness. And that's just the hard problem.
Yeah.
Like, that's just
exactly.
Like,
yeah. All right. Should we leave it there? We're not going to solve consciousness.
No.
Even though that's what
we
said. Yeah. It's a failure on our part.
but our streams touched. I feel like our streams
merged very briefly, like Peter and Paul.
Even the four guys going on their European vacation. I'm like,
I had that note. Did they all sleep in the same bed too? You know,
is this my dick or Paul's? What do you
mean? Is this like a confession? Like, if we did like a Straussian, like esoteric reading of this, this is like him coming out, which is fine, you know?
Did he know any women?
What was that, the line about the girls and the women? Like, that seemed like maybe he was a little trying to convince someone, you know?
I've seen women, not like they say. No.
I love this man, though. Not in that way, William. But I do. Like, I think, like, if you had put him on the list where I was blind ranking philosophers, and, like, I had to put him any lower than, like, four or five, I would have been upset. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think I considered him, and it was like, it's too...
It's both.
Yeah. It's not clear which one. But, yeah, I was thinking, when I was reading today, like, you know, there's 13 years of us doing this or whatever, however many... The recurring characters make me feel that warmth.
Yes.
And like the, you know, like going back to James and everybody else.
And Borges. And yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, next time we will be doing another one. And then for our beloved Patreon supporters, we'll have the second books 3 and 4 of the Odyssey coming for you next week.
Yeah, I'm excited about
me
that.
Me too. Very excited. I think our streams might cross again. join us next time on Very Bad Wizards.